Translation: those who know the Supreme Brahman attain that Supreme by passing away from the world during the influence of the fiery God in the light at an auspicious moment of the day during the fortnight of the waxing moon or during the 6 months when the sun travels in the north. So please repeat after me. Those who know the Supreme Brahman.
Those who know the Supreme Brahman.
Attain that Supreme. By passing away from the world during the influence of the fiery God.
By passing away from the world during the influence of the fiery God.
In the light.
In the light.
In the light.
At an auspicious moment of the day.
At an auspicious moment of the day.
During the fortnight of the waxing moon.
During the fortnight of the waxing moon.
Or during the 6 months when the sun travels in the north.
During the six months when the sun travels in the north.
So we could all please mute at this time. For anybody that came in a little bit late, Ishvara Prabhu is just leaving Sri Vrindavan Dham now, and his internet connection is just about to cut off, so he was not able to do class tonight. He won't be able to give till next week. So I'm giving class tonight, and Mother Vacharya Prabhu is going to read from Teachings of Lord Chaitanya tomorrow evening. And we may not be here because we have something to do over in Kona. So I'll repeat the translation one more time. Those who know the Supreme Brahman attain that Supreme by passing away from the world during the influence of the fiery God in the light. At an auspicious moment of the day, during the fortnight of the waxing moon, or during the 6 months when the sun travels in the north. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. When fire, light, day, and the fortnight of the moon are mentioned, it is to be understood that over all of them there are various presiding deities who make arrangements for the passage of the soul. At the time of death, the mind carries one on the path to the new life. If one leaves the body at the time designated above, either accidentally or by arrangement, it is possible for him to attain the impersonal Brahmajyoti. Mystics who are advanced in yoga practice can arrange the time and place to leave the body. Others have no control. If by accident they leave at an auspicious moment, then they will not return to the cycle of birth and death. But otherwise, there is every possibility that they will have to return. However, for the pure devotee in Krishna consciousness, there is no fear of returning, whether he leaves his body at an auspicious or an inauspicious moment, by accident or arrangement. Just 1 second. Om Agyana Timirandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Mili Tangyena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Mukham Kuroti Vachalam Pungang Langai Tegrim Yakripa Tamaham Bande Dinataram Sri Gurin Dinataranam. This is an interesting verse from the Bhagavad Gita. First of all, when I looked at this verse before, I kind of always looked at these series of verses that you had to get all your ducks in a row in order to utilize these principles which are being described here. But on taking another reading right now, it looks like, I think, from the purport, Prabhupada is saying that all of these things, the light, the day, the influence of fire or the moon, that they're all arranged by different demigods, the passing away from the body, And according to the arrangement of the Daiva Nitrena, the higher authorities, then you get an opportunity to pass away at a certain time, which is auspicious or inauspicious. So kind of I was thinking before that you had to get all these things right. You know, in other words, it's got to be in 6 months, and it's got to be the new moon, and it's got to be during the daytime, and, you know. But it might be, according to the, what I understand reading from this, it just influenced by different deities like that. You know, if you die, they let you die at a certain time under their influence, then you may at least attain the impersonal Brahma Jyoti. Anyway, maybe at the end we can have comments about that, if my understanding is right, or if it's even clearer. But anyway, so it's interesting when we look at this list here. We've got Agni, fire, Jyotir, the light, Aha, the day, and then Shukla, the white fortnight, you know, when the moon is waxing, or the 6 months when the sun's passing to the north, Shatmasa. My wife was telling me that because she's from Lithuania, so she kind of grew up in the northern countries, and during the summertime, the daytime lasts very, very long. Sometimes it's light all the way up until 10 o'clock at night, and then it starts getting light around 4 o'clock. But the opposite is true, that during the winter, sometimes by 4:30 in the afternoon, it's dark, and then the sun doesn't start coming, it doesn't fully rise until around 10 o'clock in the morning or something like that. I believe that's correct. Maybe she can correct me. But anyway, and during those winter months, the dark months, that's when you find there's the most suicides. So in general, you will find that those that are more in the mode of goodness, they're attracted not to sunny spots, whereas those in more modes of ignorance, they don't mind the darkness, you know, like going inside of brothels and bars. And Ravindasrup was commenting once that he had to go in out of from Sankirtan collecting at Atlantic City, and the only place to relieve himself was in one of these gambling places, you know, and when he went in, it's completely, there's no windows, so it's completely blocked off. You can't tell what time of day it is. He was noted because they're trying to make a heaven down there by no one being able to notice the passage of time. But it's bars and gambling houses, they're always dark. So when you have the influence of these things, bright, fiery, moonlight, you know, those are all auspicious. So their predominating deities control these things. And this is all being described in relationship to how one should die, because the time of death is very, very important, both for the materialist and what to speak of the spiritualist. The time of death carries the mind to the next life. Yung yung bapi, smaran bhavam. So whatever one remembers at the time of death, he will obtain that nature in his next life. At the time of death, he attains whatever he's thinking of predominantly, which is influenced by what your thoughts are throughout our lives. So in this verse, it says, Brahma, that Brahman nature, is attained by the Brahma-vidu-janaha, by those who are learned in this spiritual science. So one has to practice throughout his life to prepare himself for the moment of death. However, in the West especially, or for materialistic people in general, how they plan for death is different than how a spiritualist plans for death. Generally in the West, if somebody says, have you made plans for death? And they will immediately think of KOA plans, IRAs, you know, individual retirement accounts, retirement homes, assisted living, you know, all of those kind of things. I did a search on Google. I only had a few minutes to prepare for this class. I couldn't do much, but I did do a quick search. And if you type in planning for death, there are over 1 billion websites that have something to do with planning for death, you know, those keywords. And, I mean, obviously I couldn't go through very many, but on the first 10 pages, there are things like estate planning, taxes. Believe it or not, there's the Death Star, Star Wars. It was pretty pathetic. I was thinking the whole time I was looking through this, oh, my God. The one word that came to my mind was frivolous. This is not how you plan for death. It is extremely important that we plan for our death, but not by estate taxes and retirement homes or assisted living, but rather that when we leave our body, we will attain the ultimate destination of life. Because the foremost duty of the human being is to prepare himself for the moment of death. It's wonderful how Srila Prabhupada is pointing out that for a devotee, it doesn't matter whether he dies during auspicious time or an inauspicious time. It's very nice to read these things, you know, about what are auspicious times to leave the body. But the devotee doesn't really have to be concerned whether birth or death, you know, just like there's that verse, which I can't remember. How does it go about, you know, for the butcher, you know, it doesn't matter if he lives or dies, and for the king's son, you know, don't die right away because you had a licentious life, so your afterlife is not going to be very good.
But about that.
Yes.
For the butcher, it's better not to die or to live.
Didn't I say that?
Oh, maybe I didn't understand. I'm sorry.
Oh, whatever, anyway. It's what I meant, not what I said. So for the devotee, it doesn't matter if you live or die. For the butcher, for the butcher, don't live or die. That's right. But for the devotee, it doesn't matter if he lives or dies because everything is auspicious. So just like with death, also with birth, you know, it doesn't matter even if a devotee is born in an inauspicious family, even of dog eaters. As a matter of fact, I heard this somewhere. Maybe it was from Shureshwar. I don't quite remember. No, that's right. I was listening to a lecture on cure of souls, and the devotees were discussing this with Rubinishru, that the astrological chart for Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was inauspicious birth because it said that his family, he would have no family life, he would have no wealth, you know, it was like that kind of thing. But for a devotee, he's got Krishna karma. I forgot the word. Under the influence of the Krishna planet, what's that called? Krishna Grahi or something. So even if it looks like an inauspicious chart, that was Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So sometimes it's good for devotees to be bereft of all those things, you know, jhana and shriya, and, you know, beauty and wealth and prestige. So it doesn't matter how a devotee is born or how he dies if he's in Krishna consciousness. However, the difference is that the spiritualist in general is very, very concerned about how he dies, but not for planning estate taxes, but rather what his next life is going to be. Is it going to be in a liberated stage, or is it going to be bonded in this material world? That is the real crux of the responsibility. It's such a grave responsibility because, of course, there's 8,400,000 species of life. So you can imagine if we fall back down to the lowest species of life, it will take hundreds of millions or even billions of years to get back to this human form of life again. It's mind-boggling. How much suffering and how long it'll take to get back again to get a chance to improve our lot. So this human form of life is a junction. It should not be wasted. It's just like we're given a great, great responsibility. We were reading the other day about the lady who got multiple sclerosis, and then because of her suffering, you know, somehow they were thinking we should take on adopt some children, you know, just because they wanted to give out that love and devotion. So sometimes people will want to adopt children, which is a great, great responsibility, and it's not that easy to do. So only after going through an arduous process are you given a child, this great responsibility. And then if you buy them the best clothes, you fix up their room, you buy them cable TV, you do everything. But when the social workers come and visit, they find that the child died of starvation. You will be jailed for that. But you said, no, we bought him clothes, we fixed up his room, we got him all the toys, but you didn't feed him. Similarly, in this life, if we don't utilize this great responsibility that we have to feed our soul, then we will be responsible for that, and then in the next lifetime, we may have less than the human form of life. We should never take that chance. Rather, we should be in Krishna conscious and utilize this great gift to the ultimate good. So right now it is 6:24 p.m. Hawaii time. I'm going to stop. I actually didn't mute anybody. Thank you very much for being so quiet in the background there. I'll stop and ask if there's any questions or comments.
Jai Ananda Prabhu.
Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. Rishabh Dev Prabhu.
Yes. You know, generally, as far as I understand it, the full moon is considered to be an auspicious event. But it's interesting that it affects many people adversely, like, you know, like lunacy, like we know there's a connection like that. So don't think that's quite interesting that people are affected by the full moon in a nasty way?
Oh, that's interesting. I never thought of that. I don't know, I'm just so jaded because I always hear about, I don't know, you get werewolves or whatever when there's a new moon. But that is true, right? Lunatic. So they are affected by the phase of the moon. I don't know much about it.
Yes. Yes, it's a phenomenon that is definitely recognized. I have a colleague, right, who used to be in the police force. He was in the police force for 30 years. He said that at times he would find there's just so much going on.
All of a sudden your voice became really muffled. We can't hear you.
Okay. Right. So I said I have a colleague who was in the police for 30 years, and he said one day that sometimes, you know, they find that all of a sudden there's just so much activity, there's just so much going on. And then they would realize, or they'd just sort of, somebody would just remember, oh, it's the full moon. You know, like so many things going on and happening to people because the influence of the moon is very strong. And also in the old days, I mean, as you know, in the medieval times and earlier, that's where the word came from, actually, the lunacy, the lunatics, because people were affected by the moon. Like that. So that connection is quite true. But I was wondering whether maybe spiritually inclined people, you know, like they are affected positively, you know, people who are very spiritual in consciousness.
I never thought of it. I never seen any references, but I suppose, you know, just like if someone eats nutritious foods, if they're a good person, then that's going to help them to, you know, in their good activities. Whereas if somebody is a rascal, then when he becomes nourished, then he does abominable things. I don't know. There's an example for you. I don't know. I really never thought of it. So that it's interesting. I don't know.
Okay. Another thing is that, you know, when you said people are preparing for their deaths, like,
older people and all that with pensions and all that. And they're thinking of things like that. Here also, there are people, when you actually say somebody's preparing for their death, what comes to mind is that many old people, because they don't want to burden their children, they start to pay for funeral arrangements and choose the type of coffin they want and all things like that. They start to pay all these things so that, because funerals are becoming very expensive, you know, like that. And a very expensive thing these days. So people do not want to burden their families, and they engage in things like that, you know, that sort of planning, which all seems very, very sad, actually, in a sense. That they have to worry about that. You know, that's what it's come to. I mean, in the old days, I guess people would feel very responsible for taking care of things like this if a loved one passed away. But the nature of the world now is such that you can't even be sure that, you know, people would really care if you go like that.
Yeah, a couple of months ago, I heard a report on NPR that Costco was selling caskets. So not only they have, like, diapers and all kinds of things, but now they're selling caskets. So it's true cradle-to-grave shopping. That's the West for you.
Yes. Yeah. Also, everything's become so expensive, you know. Like, expensive in the sense that, you know, I mean, people want to have elaborate arrangements for everything, you know. So, like, funerals also very elaborate. And I saw a funeral cortege. It was so long, you know. It was a very long one with about 8 limousines and things like that. And so I told my brother about it, and I said it was probably an important person. He said, not really, because a friend of his, when his wife passed away, you know, he really, really laid it on, really big, you know, so many limousines and all that. All these things were hired, you know. So sometimes also people want to really make it very, very big. And I guess it's to make a statement that they care, you know. So it's all sorts of things going on.
I don't know if I should say this or not. We'll find out after I say it. But when I was a much younger devotee, you know, because I've been living in temple since I was 16. So when I was in my 20s, it was the first time I ever went to a funeral. We were invited to an Indian man's home. I think it was his mother. His mother had died. I'm pretty sure it was his mother. Anyway, and it was a solemn affair. The casket was right there in their living room, and you know they invited the devotees to come and do a wake for the, you know, make it auspicious like that. And I was one of the only devotees around, you know, to do it. So it was me and one or two other devotees went to do this wake and went to go speak something. And I don't know what it was that overcame me, but they're very, very solemn. You know, after the talk, he invited me to come over to the casket, you know, and view the body. And for some reason, I just started cracking up. It was like uncontrollable laughing. I don't know why that happened. It was kind of like I had never been to that kind of a ceremony before. I think it was just kind of a nervous laugh, but boy, I tell you, it's about hard to explain. Whew. But it's a fact. The way the devotees look at death is so much different than how materialists how they look at death. It's almost like if you go to a funeral, which I've been to one or two after that, and I didn't have such an embarrassing situation like that, but still, I just could not bring myself to have the kind of emotions that people almost force themselves to have at a funeral, where everybody almost forces themselves to be very, very sad and crying and say how, you know, sad they are. It's almost like it seemed artificial to me. Once you'd actually be speaking about the eternality of the soul, so that then that'll give the persons that are bereaved actually some relief, instead of just, you know, crying over it for nothing.
Well, I have to disagree with you, Ramanam. That's the question. It's not like I don't think that they are forcing themselves think that they actually genuinely grieving because they don't know anything. They think that's it. They lost, you know, completely forever. Many people don't even know that people live after death. So it's actually, it's a terrible grief. And even for devotees, I think, you know, when we lose our loved ones, you know, we still have attachment.
Actually, what I meant is, like, the people, not just the close relatives, but all the friends are supposed to cry, and all the neighbors, and the other people that they all...
Well, they have a tradition in some countries that actually they have professional criers, you know, like they're standing like a chorus, like, you know, and they cry all together. That they have, but otherwise I think people are naturally grieving. You know, like who would fake it? You know?
Yeah, okay. That, I didn't want to give that impression. No, I'm not talking about those that are actually heartbroken and really breaking up. But what I've seen from the funerals that I've gone to, at least in the West, is that people actually try to make themselves cry and feel bad in order to sympathize with the those that are bereaved, which it just seemed artificial to me. But anyway, whatever. That doesn't have much to do with what we're talking about.
Yeah, it's better than laughing.
Well, not laughing, but rather not understanding what actually... what reality is.
That's true.
Anyway, sorry for the last comments.
So what happened? You were laughing. Did anybody catch you, or did
oh my
you control
God.
Yourself? Or
yeah. Because I was standing right next to the Indian man. But as soon as I could compose myself, then I just told him that I'm just nervous. So that seemed to. He's like, thought I was nuts. But then after I said that, then he looks at all of us. It was pretty embarrassing. Phew.
As soon as you said
very
that, I started cracking up myself. I couldn't stop. I just thought it was funny.
That's been a very funny scene, actually. People must have been really wondering what was going on.
Anyway,
but actually, it's interesting. It's interesting in the Vedic tradition, you know. I mean, I know with wealthy people and all that, there was lots of big ceremonies. But it's interesting that, like, say for devotees, you know, everything is very simple, like marriage and the ceremonies. They're not very expensive, you know. These days, all these things are so expensive. People have to really plan big savings to have marriages and funerals and things like this. And in our tradition, it's all very simple and very inexpensive, and it's so much full of meaning. Everything is this day is the rituals and everything that really matter for us, and
mm-hmm.
very deep,
mm-hmm.
very nice, very meaningful occasions, you know, and very simple. You just prasad after.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really very nice. The simplicity of the process in all ways.
You know, I'm glad you brought up that point. There's a parallel also with marriage. I was just talking to my son about this, that, for instance, in the West, marriages, they're always thinking about having a nice place where they take photographs and wear this nice dress and who they're going to invite and the reception afterwards, all those things, and they could practically care less about who the priest is or what he's going to say, you know, just, you know, get it over with. It's not really very important. Whereas in the entire Vedic conception, even the Hindu conception, it's very important, the vows that are being taken and having the blessings of auspiciousness at that moment. What to speak of an actual Vedic sacrifice, you know, fire sacrifice. So it's the same way at death. So instead of, you know, worrying about how much the coffin's going to cost and, you know, who you're going to invite and all those superficial things, the real thing is, you know, preparing for the next life. So.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Prabhu, very much for listening in. Tomorrow morning, for whatever part of the world you're in, Bhagavatam class Pushkar Prabhu is giving. So we'll see everybody tomorrow. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Jai.
Jai.
Prabhupada. Jai. Hari Bol.
Jai. Hari Bol.